If there's a single moment that sums up just how absurd the 2020 presidential race feels to me right now, it's this one from George Stephanopoulos' Sunday talk show last weekend.
I'm not running for president. You know, I guarantee you that I'm not going to run for president.
This
to me, probably ever.
First, Stephanopoulos plays this tape. Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio. It's from a few years back, and Castro is denying he'd ever be interested in a presidential run. But then Stephanopoulos welcomes Castro to the show.
Listen, everybody has a right to change their minds, to find their passion. What's changed for you?
Well, a lot of things have changed, George.
Where he announces not that he's running, not quite, but that he's thinking about it. And, oh yeah, he's got a big announcement to make later this week. It was this elaborate presentation of a pretty simple idea, a presidential kabuki dance.
It is. I think kabuki is the exact right term for it. It's just sort of the ritual of running.
Jamelle Bouie's been Slate's political guru for years. I asked him to tell me I'm not crazy, even though presidential campaign coverage can make me feel that way as I try to keep track of exploratory committees and chicken dinners in Iowa.
It's, for whatever reason, considered to be bad form to just sort of plainly say, I want to be president and I'm going to run for it and I've been planning this for some time. You have to pretend as if that somehow isn't the case.
Like it or not, we're going to be seeing a lot more of these announcements about announcements. Jamelle says even if it feels like it's too early to be paying attention, it isn't.
Political scientists identify something called the invisible primary, and that's just the term given to all of the jockeying and sort of maneuvering that happens before people start to vote. You know, figures like Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, they've been making the rounds in South Carolina and Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada. They've been visiting these places for the past 2 years. I mean, when you start to hear these announcements, I wouldn't think of them as early. I would think of them as more or less right on time.
I mean, I guess while all this stuff kind of makes me a little bit tired, I feel like you see it a little bit differently. I feel like you have this bottomless curiosity about it and how it's going to turn out.
I mean, I think part of my perspective here is obviously the personalities matter here, but I'm not necessarily looking at it purely in terms of the personalities. I'm looking at it as a process.
Jamelle doesn't think about this in terms of one candidate versus another. Not yet, anyway. He thinks about how all these candidates are changing what we talk about and how.
You know, I actually really understand the sense of being sort of exhausted by it all. But for me, my interest is sort of in how familiar dynamics play out, how certain candidates connect and certain candidates don't. I have a framework for thinking about it. And there's a degree to which I'm kind of plugging in the values for any given election.
So today, Jamelle's going to show me the 2020 presidential contest from his perspective. If politics is one big experiment, Jamelle's got a bunch of hypotheses he's looking to test out. And even though the election itself is still a while away, he's got some hints about what's coming next. Stay with us. I'm going to start here, which is we're talking a lot about the Democrats because obviously open field for them. But I want to talk about the Republicans. And it's kind of obvious, but I'm wondering, what are the Republicans going to be testing out in terms of what works, in terms of messaging, in terms of what they want to say?
That's a good question. I think that the institutional Republican Party, which I think just refers more or less to the longstanding body of activists, donors, lawmakers who have kind of been in the game for a while, institutions like the Republican National Committee, that kind of thing, they're going to want to run a very standard issue incumbency campaign. I actually would not be surprised if they try to lean on the 1984 Reagan campaign, Morning in America. They'll emphasize economic growth, they'll emphasize wage growth, they'll emphasize like relative peace and prosperity. The problem for the institutional Republican Party is that Donald Trump, the president, understands his victory in 2016 as basically a product of the kind of breathless, fear-mongering, anti-immigrant, you know, America's on the verge of chaos message. So I think messaging-wise, that one of the dynamics to look at, to look forward, to examine over the next 2 years is the conflict between the president's messaging and the institutional Republican Party's messaging and how they attempt to square the circle. Now, it's possible, given especially the degree to which Republican Party elites have basically gone all in on the president, that they'll simply adopt his style of messaging, that there won't be any particular divide between the two. But I think there'll be some tension there.
And we just saw this midterm result where, in one sense, the sort of Donald Trump, you know, America is in chaos message worked in that it turned out the very dedicated base. But in another sense, it really turned off a lot of the electorate, right?
Donald Trump's Republican allies, they lost more or less every single demographic category other than white men. And I think they narrowly won whites without college degrees. Every other group, they lost, and many of them by significant margins. And I think what's critical is if you look at a House map, or not a House map, if you just look at a map of the United States with House districts on it, and superimpose that on a map of the Electoral College, Democratic House victories, given where they occur, the states that they occurred in, they correspond to basically like a modest Electoral College win. Yes, Republicans held the Senate, but other than Florida, I believe, those were all red state seats. There's not really, you know, that doesn't really translate into anything major for the party's presidential prospects. And so, yeah, that message, if we're looking at a national election, that message can be very damaging. And the second, I think there's a second thing here, and that is Donald Trump is very unpopular. His administration, you could fairly say, is in chaos. He faces criminal investigation. Several close associates have been indicted. It's entirely possible that by the end of this year, his presidency might be falling apart in a dramatic way, more so than it is now. And so there are whispers of a primary campaign, and Republican leaders are clearly worried about someone trying to primary the president. So if that happens, if John
Someone
Kasich,
trying to primary the president? I love that.
If John Kasich of Ohio jumps in, if Mitt Romney decides to take a shot at it, that will be a real dilemma for the party. Not that Trump would necessarily lose the nomination. I can't even think of a time that's ever happened in American politics ever. But a sitting president facing a primary challenge is like a bad omen for the election, in part because it signals really critical weakness within the party base. So Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush both faced primaries when they ran for re-election, and they both lost. And I think there's a connection between the two things. So that's another thing for Republicans to worry about.
Well, you know, you're painting this as really a fight a little bit for the soul of the Republican Party, but it seems to me that it's also this fight for the soul of the Democratic Party, because right now we're seeing these really progressive ideas coming out of Democrats, both people who are announcing that they are running for president, but then also people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's not running for president, but she's new in Washington. And I have to say, like, I never thought my Twitter would be blowing up about the marginal tax rate, but this weekend it did, and it sort of spurred conversation among the 2020 candidates about it. So how do you think all that is going to influence where the Democratic Party is going?
I mean, it's clear that whether people label themselves progressives or populist or socialists, it's clear that the Democratic Party base is moving to the left, is looking for sort of larger, more expansive solutions to the problems, is looking for people who are like vocally anti-Trump. It's been funny over the past 2 years, one of the recurring kind of narratives is that Democrats can't just be anti-Trump. But looking at election results, looking at who's catching fire with voters and Democratic voters and independents, it appears that you can just be anti-Trump. A lot of voters want people in office who kind of represent their anger and disgust at the president. And Ocasio-Cortez does that. And so I'm not sure every Democrat running will adopt her particular kinds of policy positions, but I think many of the Democrats running will adopt her sort of, I think it's sincere anger, but it's also performed anger at the president, at the Republican Party. That's I think, a big influence she'll have.
One, it's not just the anger. It's like when she mentioned raising taxes really significantly, all of a sudden we saw, you know, Julian Castro, who is running for president, as far as we know, go on the Sunday shows and say, yeah, like that sounds like a great idea. And it just feels like a conversation that we wouldn't have had 4 years ago, 8 years ago.
I think that's right. I mean, I don't have any deeper analysis other than to say that it's been fascinating to watch her a statement that, you know, there should be a 70% marginal tax rate on the very rich, immediately sort of open up the space for discussing high marginal tax rates. I mean, it's noteworthy, right, that the discussion about tax rates is now whether 70% is necessarily too high. Maybe we could go higher. And then also the conversation is about historical tax rates, that the response to that's insane isn't, you know, maybe we'll moderate. It's, hey, 30 years, 40 years ago, tax rates were even higher. So what's necessarily problematic about this? I think smart Democratic presidential aspirants, if they're paying attention to this, will take it as confirmation that they can propose things that may have been considered out of the mainstream even 5 years ago. And not only will voters, observers take them seriously, there may be a chorus of defense from their side saying, no, in fact, that this is not an unreasonable thing and that we should think seriously about it and we should pursue it.
Yeah. I mean, like a good example of this to me, just looking from the outside, is a candidate like Jay Inslee, who is a governor of Washington State. And has been out there saying my campaign's about climate change, which, I mean, I guess Al Gore was maybe the last candidate to really make climate change a huge part of the agenda. And it made me wonder, like, are we ready for a candidate who is having that as their main message?
I actually think that in the same way that healthcare was a major part of the 2016 campaign, I think climate, the Green New Deal that Ocasio-Cortez has been pushing, is going to be a major part of the 2020 election. I think there's, on the Democratic left and increasingly sort of in the Democratic center left and center, kind of really growing urgency about climate, especially knowing that a Republican administration is just not going to attempt to solve the problem. So I think Inslee is wisely has a sense of what the issue space is going to look like and is trying to get ahead of other candidates on this. And it'll remain to be seen if other presidential hopefuls meet him by going even more expansive.
I mean, because you think about the history of elections and you think about the history of this country, I guess I'm wondering, we're seeing these really progressive ideas coming out. When was the last time we were having conversations like this with voters? Like, it seems new. And I wonder if there are lessons from history about, like, the last time we sort of had these conversations about structural change.
I mean, it is new in the sense that there is a turning away from the kind of, I think, timidity of Democratic politicians of the 90s and the 2000s. Some of that, I think, is attributable purely to Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign. I think some of it's attributable to generational change. I think something underrated in understanding the dynamics of Democratic Party politics is that you have a generation of politicians who came of age in an era of Republican ascendance. On the oldest side of this are people who won office in the late 70s, who saw the Reagan Revolution, who saw Bush win, who saw Clinton adjust to the realities of that, who saw openly liberal Democrats like Mondale and Dukakis lose in major ways. So kind of experienced kind of a real backlash against liberalism and adjusted accordingly and met the challenge by essentially adopting the rhetorical stylings of and basic assumptions of conservative governance. And then you have a generation of Democrats who entered politics 20 years later, 25 years later, when Republicans still held power but didn't hold the same kind of monopoly on sort of political discourse, who saw the collapse of the Bush administration, who saw the backlash to Obama's conciliatory rhetoric and decided that, you know, the response to this is to just be openly and unapologetically liberal. Bernie Sanders' campaign again demonstrated that one can embrace big universal policies and not see a particular backlash. So all those things put together, it does shape the public conversation in a new way. There's a new sense or a growing sense or some combination of the two that the United States needs a more robust social safety net, that it needs, you know, bold, broad action on a whole host of issues, and that the American public is ready to consider those policies. Also, kind of a factor influencing all of this is the experience of the Affordable Care Act, and that is, it was pieced together from various sources. I think it's a closer point of comparison, but it was attempt to compromise to say that we have this goal of extending coverage, and so we're going to use market mechanisms and sort of government based mechanisms. And 8 years after, or 9 years after its passage almost, what are the most popular and lasting and durable parts of the Affordable Care Act? It's the Medicaid expansion. It's the part that really is just kind of a blunt object of a policy. The government extends Medicaid eligibility to more people. That's it.
The marketplace isn't really the popular part.
Right. No one's clamoring to preserve the exchanges, right? It created a whole new constituency of people for, you know, government subsidized provided health insurance.
And now a lot of Democratic candidates are talking about Medicare for all.
Right. I think the lesson drawn from that is that there's no, not only is there no political point in trying to, you know, develop some kind of ideological policy compromise, taking, you know, right-leaning ideas, conservative ideas, because we're not going to get any good faith response for it, but that if we want to really strengthen and preserve the program for the duration, it's just a simple expansion of government policy is going to do the trick. And I think that's also influencing how Democrats are looking at the policy question this election. And I mean, I'll say this. Cory Booker of New Jersey is, I think, what you'd call like a moderate liberal Democrat. He's not, you know, a firebrand. He's not, you know, rhetorically, he's not sort of like someone. He's not like Ocasio-Cortez or Sanders or anyone. Cory Booker is proposing as part of his, you know, soon-to-be campaign a policy called baby bonds. That's sort of the name for the type of policy, whereby every single American child born after the policy is passed gets a couple thousand dollars in savings bonds. They get the full value of them at age 18. Every year, the government puts more money into the savings account so that by the time they're 18, you know, everyone will have like 25 grand that they can just like, congratulations, you're 18 years old, here's $25,000.
It's like Social Security for young people.
Right. And that depending on sort of demographic characteristics, like, you know, your zip code or whatever, you may get more than that, like a supplement. It's hard to imagine a Democrat openly talking about that 10 years ago, right? Like, that would have seemed radical 10 years ago, but things have moved forward.
Jamelle Bouie has been Slate's political correspondent, and he's now headed to the New York Times. He's going to start this month. Congratulations, Jamelle.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
While we were talking about the 2020 presidential hopefuls, I jumped down one more rabbit hole with Jamelle. Jamelle told me he's wondering if this is going to be a particularly bad time to be a Democratic presidential candidate who's white. Okay, I know you're like, did the revolution happen while I was sleeping? No, everything's the same. But Jamelle says race and how a candidate thinks about race, if past elections made it subtext, the last presidential contest made it text.
I think what on the Democratic side is a bit of a dilemma is this need to show social solidarity with voters of color, which is important, which is not something that should be abandoned. It's a very vital thing in American politics right now. So how do you do that without also helping to polarize the entire election along racial issues.
For white Democrats, proving they aren't racist will mean showing how un-Trump they really are, which is going to feed right into the narrative Republicans are trying to sell that Democrats are ignoring white voters. Jamel says, think back to the midterms when that video came out with Beto O'Rourke at a black church talking about police violence.
How can it be in this day and age, in this very year, in this community, that a young man, African-American, in his own apartment, is shot and killed by a police officer?
His opponent, Senator Ted Cruz, actually tweeted this video out as if he was saying to voters, see? And of course, Ted Cruz won that contest. For Jamel, it's a kind of warning to other white Democrats.
You know, if you're a candidate of color and a Democrat, it's a little easier because you can simply embody the opposition to Trump's racism. You don't have to say anything. It's just you being a black man, you being a black woman, you being a Latino man. That alone says I oppose these things. If you're a white candidate, it's a little different. You might have to actually be kind of vocal about it. But in being vocal about it, you might activate or spark this dynamic. And I don't know how that's going to play out, but it might be a little difficult.
That's the show. We are back 5 days a week, coming down your feed bright and early. Tell us what you think by leaving us a rating and a review on iTunes. That review is how other people find us, so give us a little love. On Twitter, you can find us at Slate Podcasts, or you can just find me at Mary's Desk. What Next is hosted by me, Mary Harris, and produced by Mary Wilson and Jason DeLeon. Talk to you tomorrow.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.